Chapter 150. Esther's narrative. I had gone to bed and fallen asleep when my guardian knocked at the door of my room and begged me to get up directly. On my hurrying to speak to him and learn what had happened, he told me, after a word or two of preparation, that there had been a discovery at Sir Leicester Dedlock's. That my mother had fled, that a person was now at our door who was empowered to convey to her the fullest assurances of affectionate protection and forgiveness, if he could possibly find her, and that I was sought for, to accompany him in the hope that my entreaties might prevail upon her if his failed. Something to this general purpose I made out, but I was thrown into such a tumult of alarm, and hurry and distress, that in spite of every effort I could make to subdue my agitation, I did not seem, to myself, fully to recover my right mind until hours had passed. But I dressed and wrapped up expeditiously without waking Charlie or anyone, and went down to Mr. Bucket, who was the person entrusted with the secret. And taking me to him, my guardian told me this, and also explained how it was that he had come to think of me. Mr. Bucket, in a low voice, by the light of my guardian's candle, read to me in the hall a letter that my mother had left upon her table, and I suppose within 10 minutes of my having been aroused I was sitting beside him, rolling swiftly through the streets. His manner was very keen, and yet considerate when he explained to me that a great deal might depend on my being able to answer, without confusion, a few questions that he wished to ask me. These were, chiefly, whether I had had much communication with my mother, to whom he only referred as Lady Dedlock, when and where I had spoken with her last, and how she had become possessed of my handkerchief. When I had satisfied him on these points, he asked me particularly to consider taking time to think whether within my knowledge there was anyone, no matter where, in whom she might be at all likely to confide under circumstances of the last necessity. I could think of no one but my guardian. But by and by I mentioned Mr. Boythorn. He came into my mind as connected with his old chivalrous manner of mentioning my mother's name, and with what my guardian had informed me of his engagement to her sister, and his unconscious connection with her unhappy story. My companion had stopped the driver while we held this conversation, that we might the better hear each other. He now told him to go on again, and said to me, after considering within himself for a few moments, that he had made up his mind how to proceed. He was quite willing to tell me what his plan was, but I did not feel clear enough to understand it. We had not driven very far from our lodgings, when we stopped in a by-street at a public-looking place lighted up with gas. Mr. Bucket took me in, and sat me in an armchair by a bright fire. It was now past one, as I saw by the clock against the wall. Two police officers, looking in their perfectly neat uniform, not at all like people who were up all night, were quietly writing at a desk, and the place seemed very quiet altogether, except for some beating and calling out at distant doors underground, to which nobody paid any attention. A third man in uniform, whom Mr. Bucket called, and to whom he whispered his instructions, went out, and then the two others advised together, while one wrote from Mr. Bucket's subdued dictation. It was a description of my mother that they were busy with, for Mr. Bucket brought it to me when it was done, and read it in a whisper. It was very accurate indeed. The second officer, who had attended to it closely, then copied it out and called in another man in uniform. There were several in an outer room, who took it up, and went away with it. All this was done with the greatest dispatch, and without the waste of a moment, yet nobody was at all hurried. As soon as the paper was sent out upon its travels, the two officers resumed their former quiet work of writing with neatness and care. Mr. Bucket thoughtfully came and warmed the soles of his boots, first one and then the other, at the fire. "Are you well wrapped up, Miss Summerson?" he asked me as his eyes met mine. "It's a desperate sharp night for a young lady to be out in." I told him I cared for no weather, and was warmly clothed. "It may be a long job," he observed, but so that it ends well. Never mind, miss. I pray to heaven it may end well, said one. He nodded comfortingly. You see, whatever you do, don't you go and fret yourself. You keep yourself cool and equal for anything that may happen, and it'll be the better for you, the better for me, the better for Lady Dedlock, and the better for Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet. He was really very kind and gentle, and as he stood before the fire warming his boots, and rubbing his face with his forefinger, I felt a confidence in his sagacity which reassured me. It was not yet 2:15 when I heard horses' feet and wheels outside. Now, Miss Summerson, said he, we are off, if you please. He gave me his arm, and the two officers courteously bowed me out, and we found at the door a Phaetoner barriage with a postillion and post horses. Mr. Bucket handed me in, and took his own seat on the box. The man in uniform whom he had sent to fetch this equipage then handed him up a dark lantern at his request, and when he had given a few directions to the driver, we rattled away. I was far from sure that I was not in a dream. We rattled with great rapidity through such a labyrinth of streets that I soon lost all idea where we were, except that we had crossed and recrossed the river, and still seemed to be traversing a low-lying, waterside, dense neighborhood of narrow thoroughfares checkered by docks and basins, high piles of warehouses, swing bridges, and masts of ships. At length we stopped at the corner of a little slimy turning, which the wind from the river, rushing up it, did not purify, and I saw my companion, by the light of his lantern, in conference with several men who looked like a mixture of police and sailors. Against the mouldering wall by which they stood, there was a bill, on which I could discern the words, Found Drowned, and this and an inscription about Drax, possessed me with the awful suspicion shadowed forth in our visit to that place. I had no need to remind myself that I was not there by the indulgence of any feeling of mine, to increase the difficulties of the search, or to lessen its hopes, or enhance its delays. I remained quiet, but what I suffered in that dreadful spot I never can forget. And still it was like the horror of a dream. A man yet dark and muddy, in long swollen sodden boots and a hat like him, was called out of a boat and whispered with Mr. Bucket, who went away with him down some slippery steps, as if to look at something secret that he had to show. They came back, wiping their hands upon their coats, after turning over something wet. But thank God it was not what I feared. After some further conference, Mr. Bucket, whom everybody seemed to know and defer to, went in with the others at a door and left me in the carriage, while the driver walked up and down by his horses to warm himself. The tide was coming in, as I judged from the sound it made, and I could hear it break at the end of the alley with a little rush towards me. It never did so, and I thought it did so, hundreds of times, in what can have been at the most 1/4 hour, and probably was less, but the thought shuddered through me, that it would cast my mother at the horse's feet. Mr. Bucket came out again, exhorting the others to be vigilant, darkened his lantern, and once more took his seat. Don't you be alarmed, Miss Summerson, on account of our coming down here, he said, turning to me. I only want to have everything in train, and to know that it is in train, by looking after it myself. Get on, my lad. We appeared to retrace the way we had come. Not that I had taken note of any particular objects, in my perturbed state of mind, but judging from the general character of the streets. We called at another officer station for a minute, and crossed the river again. During the whole of this time, and during the whole search, my companion, wrapped up on the box, never relaxed in his vigilance a single moment, but when we crossed the bridge he seemed, if possible, to be more on the alert than before. He stood up to look over the parapet, he alighted and went back after a shadowy female figure that flitted past us, and he gazed into the profound black pit of water with a face that made my heart die within me. The river had a fearful look, so overcast and secret, creeping away so fast between the low flat lines of shore so heavy with indistinct and awful shapes, both of substance and shadow, so deathlike and mysterious. I have seen it many times since then, by sunlight and by moonlight, but never free from the impressions of that journey. In my memory, the lights upon the bridge are always burning dim, the cutting wind is eddying round the homeless woman whom we pass, the monotonous wheels are whirling on, and the light of the carriage lamps reflected back looks palely in upon me, a face rising out of the dreaded water. Clattering and clattering through the empty streets, we came at length from the pavement onto dark smooth roads, and began to leave the houses behind us. After a while I recognized the familiar way to St. Albans. At Barnet fresh horses were ready for us, and we changed and went on. It was very cold indeed, and the open country was white with snow, though none was falling then. An old acquaintance of yours, this road, Miss Summerson, said Mr. Bucket cheerfully. Yes, I returned. Have you gathered any intelligence? None that can be quite depended on as yet, he answered, but it's early times as yet. He had gone into every later early public house, where there was a light, they were not a few at that time, the road being then much frequented by drovers, and had got down to talk to the turnpike keepers. I had heard him ordering drink, and chinking money, and making himself agreeable and merry everywhere. But whenever he took his seat upon the box again, his face resumed its watchful steady look, and he always said to the driver in the same business tone, "Get on, my lad." With all these stoppages, it was between 5 and 6 o'clock, and we were yet a few miles short of St. Albans, when he came out of one of these houses, and handed me in a cup of tea. "Drink it, Miss Summerson, it'll do you good. You're beginning to get more yourself now, ain't you?" I thanked him, and said I hoped so. "You was what you may call stunned at first," he returned. "And Lord, no wonder. Don't speak loud, my dear. It's all right. She's on the head." I don't know what joyful exclamation I made, or was going to make, but he put up his finger, and I stopped myself. "Passed through here on foot this evening about 8 or 9. I heard of her first at the archway toll, over at Highgate, but couldn't make quite sure. Traced her all along, on, and off. Picked her up at one place, and dropped her at another. But she's before us now, safe. Take hold of this cup and saucer, ostler. Now, if you wasn't brought up to the butter trade, look out and see if you can catch half a crown in your t'other hand. 1, 2, 3, and there you are. Now, my lad, try a gallop." We were soon in St. Albans, and alighted a little before day, when I was just beginning to arrange and comprehend the occurrences of the night and really to believe that they were not a dream. Leaving the carriage at the posting house and ordering fresh horses to be ready, my companion gave me his arm, and we went towards home. "As this is your regular abode, Miss Summerson, you see," he observed, "I should like to know whether you've been asked for by any stranger answering the description, or whether Mr. Jarndyce has. I don't much expect it, but it might be." As we ascended the hill, he looked about him with a sharp eye. The day was now breaking, and reminded me that I had come down it one night, as I had reason for remembering, with my little servant and poor Joe, whom he called Toey. I wondered how he knew that. "When you passed a man upon the road, just yonder, you know," said Mr. Bucket. "Yes, I remembered that too, very well." "That was me," said Mr. Bucket. Seeing my surprise, he went on, "I drove down in a gig that afternoon to look after that boy. You might have heard my wheels when you came out to look after him yourself, for I was aware of you and your little maid going up when I was walking the horse down. Making an inquiry or two about him in the town, I soon heard what company he was in, and was coming among the brick fields to look for him, when I observed you bringing him home here. Had he committed any crime?" I asked. "None was charged against him," said Mr. Bucket, coolly lifting off his hat, "but I suppose he wasn't over particular." "No. What I wanted him for was in connection with keeping this very matter of Lady Dedlock quiet. He had been making his tongue more free than welcome, as to a small accidental service he had been paid for by the deceased Mr. Tulkinghorn, and it wouldn't do, at any sort of price, to have him playing those games. So having warned him out of London, I made an afternoon of it to warn him to keep out of it now he was away, and go farther from it, and maintain a bright lookout, that I didn't catch him coming back again. Poor creature, said one. Poor enough, assented Mr. Bucket, and trouble enough, and well enough away from London, or anywhere else. I was regularly turned on my back when I found him taken up by your establishment, I do assure you. I asked him why. Why, my dear, said Mr. Bucket. Naturally there was no end to his tongue then. He might as well have been born with a yard and a half of it, and a remnant over. Although I remember this conversation now, my head was in confusion at the time, and my power of attention hardly did more than enable me to understand that he entered into these particulars to divert me. With the same kind intention, manifestly, he often spoke to me of indifferent things, while his face was busy with the one object that we had in view. He still pursued this subject as we turned in at the garden gate. Ah, said Mr. Bucket. Here we are, and a nice retired place it is. Puts a man in mind of the country house in the woodpecker tapping, that was known by the smoke which so gracefully curled. They early with the kitchen fire, and that denotes good servants. But what you've always got to be careful of with servants, is who comes to see 'em. You never know what they're up to, if you don't know that. And another thing, my dear. Whenever you find a young man behind the kitchen door, you give that young man in charge on suspicion of being secreted in a dwelling house with an unlawful purpose. We were now in front of the house. He looked attentively and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.